meditation, as usual, and then we will proceed with today's talk. I allow the body and the mind to settle down. Letting go of all sounds and sensations. Experience my entire existence converging, concentrating. A sparkling star. Shine. Experience as though this physical body and this physical world has disappeared. All that remains is light. I see myself a sparkling star of consciousness. Beyond the earth, beyond the moon, beyond the sun, beyond. beyond the limits of space and time. I see myself in a dimension of silence. And I see myself in the presence of God. The Supreme Light. Sparkling down upon me. A shower of light. This body, this costume of mine, I, the eternal spirit, seated in the center of the brain, spreading the light of life throughout the brain and the body. Looking out through the windows of these eyes, listening through these ears. Silent and peaceful. At peace with myself. At peace with the world. Om Shanti. Yes, good afternoon once again. In the olden days, in a lot of ancient systems of medicine, very frequently you might have heard of this one cure all, one medicine that would cure all illnesses, right? Panacea, they would say. In some traditions, panacea. You have that, everything is cured. Is it possible? One medicine for all illnesses. Take that, everything will, that would be wonderful, right? Can it happen like that? In the study of Raja Yoga that we have actually just one real important concept, which is the beginning of the study and the practice of Raja Yoga meditation, which is the end of the practice of Raja Yoga meditation, and that is the concept of the soul and the concept of soul consciousness. There is not much beyond that. The entire philosophy of Raja Yoga is centered around the concept of soul. And then there are two supporting concepts. One is the concept of God, the Supreme, and the other is the concept of creation. How we create our destiny through our karma, through our actions, and how that influences us. The whole philosophy of action, the philosophy of karma. But fundamentally, everything is centered around the concept of the soul. And the aim is to reach a state of soul consciousness. That's it, there is nothing else really. And everything that is practiced is centered around this concept of becoming soul conscious. But of course, it's a very deep thing. What is soul consciousness? But everything really is centered around that. It's pretty simple that way. It's pretty simple that way. But then, what is soul consciousness? To understand that and to experience that, obviously we need to go into a lot of depth. Depth of that same concept. Depth of that same concept. In Hindi, there is a very nice word that is used to speak about solitude. You know solitude? Being on your own, spending time with, like, you, for example, sitting in meditation, you spend time on your own. Solitude. The Hindi word for solitude is ekant. It's a word with many meanings. Ekant. Ek is one. Ant is the end. Going into the end, going into the depths of one. That is the meaning of solitude in Hindi. Going into the depths of one. Going into the depth of a concept. And that's actually not very strange and not very different from, say, what many scientists try to do. Many inventions, many theories emerge from the investigation of a single concept. So you take up a single thing. Say, for example, people want to study consciousness. You start with a simple thing. What is consciousness? And then you go into the depth of that single concept in trying to understand how it operates. It's pretty similar what we do with soul consciousness. So it's one concept, but then you go into the depth of that concept to try and understand what it really means and how it can be applied. Whatever we do, all the talks we have here, the meditation course we have in the center, the morning Murali classes we have for those who have finished the entire meditation course, everything is aimed at creating soul consciousness. So today we will look at another way of approaching soul consciousness, and that is through addressing the problems of confusion. What is confusion? Today's topic is confusion, clarity, and the powers to discern and decide. So we begin with confusion. What is confusion? Let's begin with that simple question. What is confusion? If we are to find an answer to confusion, we need to understand, first of all, what is confusion? So what is confusion? How do we understand confusion? Spend a minute on that. What is confusion for you? How do you experience confusion? Is there one way of experiencing confusion? Are there different ways of experiencing confusion? What is confusion?
Chaos. Chaos.
What do you mean by that? Chaos. There is a lot of a very interesting application of chaos theory now in many disciplines. right? A lot of modern thinking around chaos is that chaos is good. You need chaos for creativity, but you need to balance chaos with some order. There's a lot of thinking around that. But if you equate chaos with confusion, what is confusion itself? How do we understand confusion? So, let's say we have our friend Confusion here. It is our friend, isn't it? Yes.
When you lose direction?
Losing direction, that's interesting. Loss of direction. Loss of orientation. Does it make sense? Can you relate to that? A loss of direction, a loss of orientation. We could say loss of orientation or direction. Many a times, people, elderly people who develop dementia, you find that, right? They get confused. They don't know where they are. Sense of loss of direction, loss of orientation. Okay? But how does it manifest, this loss of direction, loss of orientation? How does it manifest? In your experience, how does it manifest? What is the experience of confusion? Yes?
Losing control.
Sense of losing control. Okay. What else?
You don't know what to choose.
So one is this experience of being unable to decide between alternatives. So there are many alternatives, two or more alternatives. And we are unable to decide. So let us say inability to choose. So let us say there is the issue of choice between alternatives. Okay, this is one way in which confusion manifests itself quite clearly. People need to decide whether to stay in a marriage or get out of a marriage, for example, to stay with a job or to get out of the job, or which job to choose. Not so many choices in the world these days, but still, you know, which career to choose, which job to choose. There are choices. Do I say something to someone or do I keep quiet? What manner do I approach that person? Do I approach that person with assertiveness or do I approach the person with softness? How do I approach? How do I bring up my children? You know, choice. This is one issue that creates some confusion. You were saying something?
I was just going to say, like awareness, that you have to, that you become aware that you don't know maybe what is correct or true.
Yeah. So there is this, you don't know what is correct and true. And that is very true. That we don't know what is correct or true. We don't know which way to go. And one way that can manifest is when we have to make a choice. Could there be other ways in which that same experience can manifest? Where we don't know what to do. That's essentially what you're saying. We don't know what to do. We don't know what is true or what is right for us to do. So one is choosing between alternatives, and that can create confusion. Could there be other ways that it can manifest itself?
Not choosing at all, kind of like a state of paralysis.
A state of paralysis, a state of blankness, inability to decide on anything, and inability to even see alternatives. Have you experienced it sometimes? Complete blankness. I don't even know what the alternatives are, and yet there is something I have to do, and yet it is completely blank. Complete loss of orientation, direction. I don't know what to do. I cannot even see clearly. This is another experience of, lack of alternative, a sort of a state of blankness that I experience. So it can manifest in different ways. Could there be other ways in which that can manifest? Yes?
You overstimulate yourself with actions.
Yeah. So one is this overstimulation. There is too much of stimulation, and the other is probably no stimulation, something similar. So on the other hand, you have, say, a lot of alternatives, so you could say there is the experience of overstimulation connected to this, and then you could say either no or very low stimulation,
where I really am unable to figure out anything that I need to do. So something related to this.
Could there be other experiences as well? Anything else that you've experienced as a manifestation of confusion, the way in which confusion can manifest itself? Yes?
Unhappy.
And that is, of course, the result. Then there is unhappiness. Because I'm unable to choose between alternatives, or I'm unable to find really anything to do, any alternative, it gives me a sense of a loss of direction and emptiness. Then there is the experience of unhappiness. Were you saying something?
Yeah, maybe it's the same, but I can feel it when I am overloaded with information.
Mm. It creates a less overstimulation.
Yes.
It's too much information, too much happening, too many alternatives, and I'm unable to decide. And the other is I just don't know. There's nothing. There's not much stimulation. I can't figure out what to do. It's a state of blackness, emptiness. And either way, it can lead to, of course, so this is like the manifestation.
It can lead to a state that is obviously not very nice.
Empty, you feel unhappy. What is the reason behind this? Say, for example, inability to choose between various alternatives. Where do you suppose that comes from? Why are we unable to choose between alternatives?
Because once we make the choice, we become locked in, and we don't want the consequence of that choice.
So there is some fear, maybe?
Fear.
One is you have locked yourself into something.
Or away from with the other choice.
Yeah. So either on the one hand, there could be some attachment to something that you're unwilling to let go. And choosing an alternative might mean letting that go. And that creates some fear. So there could be an element of attachment. There could be an element of fear. What else?
Yeah. Not being able to face the self or something.
Again, fear.
Also fear.
Yeah. So we could say, yeah, various experiences. There is one, the experience of attachment. There is something I am very deeply attached to and I don't want to let go of that, and that creates fear.
What else? Yeah?
I just think about if you are in development in life, you go through some crisis or what do you call it? And confusion can maybe be before you take the next step to a better way to approach, to handle life.
So that could be actually a nice thing, if you can figure out what to do after that.
I mean, you see the darkness, it's most dark before you see the light, or like that.
Very nice way of looking at it.
And
that is true, right?
Just a thought.
No, but that's a very nice thought, and that's also quite true. We also know that many times people enter a state of chaos, but that chaos is very good because then that sort of forces us to question our assumptions, to question all these things we've been working with. And so that chaos, that confusion can be a good, you could say, a stage to something higher. That is true. But let's look at the reasons behind so we can address that. Yes, you were saying something?
I mean, I was linking with something that has potential as well, and that could lead to a confusion, a state of confusion.
Like what?
I mean, it could be two things. Two job offers are very good. You can decide if you should go abroad or you should stay here because you have a good life. And I mean, I think automatically people are making confusion with something that is negative. And I think...
Connected to what you said, doesn't necessarily have to be negative. We are not going into the negative or positive aspects of it. We're trying to understand it.
Sure.
And see, so there is also desire. The many things I want to do. And I'm unable to choose between what is it that would be best. I want all the options, I want it all. There is a lot of interesting research around decision making. And a lot of very interesting findings tell us people don't really take or make decisions in that cool, rational manner that we would like to believe that we make decisions, you know, deliberately excluding choices after choice by careful reasoning. No, we don't really make decisions like that. A lot of studies show that decision making is pretty chaotic. It's pretty random. It's not as disciplined as we would like to believe. Henry Mintzberg, the very famous management researcher and management guru, so-called management guru, he went around asking people, studying managers on how they took decisions in large organizations, top-level managers, and his finding was basically, it's really chaotic. They don't really weigh all the alternatives, you know, all that stuff we are taught in the classroom, how to take decisions, the steps and processes of decision making, weigh all the alternatives, look at the various aspects. None of that really works. Why? They don't have the time, they don't have the resources, and most importantly, they don't even have all the information. In reality, many of us take decisions in the lack of information, lack of time, lack of resources. So at the end of the day, people end up taking decisions that are good enough. In the language of decision-making science, they say they are satisficing. They're good enough. And some people try to have decisions that are maximizing the best possible decision you can take in the situation. And very interestingly, these are the people who regret the decisions the most. Because there are so many, they want to have the best. You can never have the best, you have to compromise somewhere, right? So you end up with some sort of a solution which you believe is the best, but it's not good enough. And then you end up regretting that decision. It can be a simple thing like buying something in a shop. The best possible pair of shoes. And after having investigated all the possible shops in Copenhagen, you buy a pair of shoes, you go home and you think you've got the wrong pair. And then you have to go and return it and exchange it and get another pair. It can be a simple thing like that. It could be more complex decisions. Decision making is chaotic. We know that. Right here, we are trying to figure out what can create some element of clarity in the process. So, it is sometimes good to enter a state of confusion because we can test our assumptions, we can challenge our assumptions. But then, what will emerge from that? How do we emerge in a reasonably clear state of mind from that that we can actually decide? That's what we would look into. Another way, another possible reason behind actual confusion could also be perhaps something that is behind this sense of being blocked, being blank, a state of meaninglessness. I am unable to see any meaning, any purpose behind whatever alternatives I have in front of me. Nothing seems to make sense. It is meaningless. I am unable to see meaning in it. It is not connected to what will give me a sense of meaning. And therefore I am sort of lost. There is no direction. There is no focus. So we want to move from the state of confusion, loss of orientation, to some element, some reasonable experience of clarity. What can give us clarity? Looking at your own lives, think for a couple of minutes on this. Times when you have been confused in your life, it could be a confusion where you had to choose between different alternatives. It could also be a confusion where there is really nothing that you could think of, state of being blank, this sense of lack of movement forward, lack of alternatives, complete state of, blankness, whatever it could be. What helped you in moving from that state of lack of orientation to some state of clarity? Spend a minute thinking on this. Yes.
Well, if I have a lack of what to do now, nothing seems to give me meaning. I'm looking for maybe some little thing that could give meaning to me.
Give some meaning.
Yes. So that I have something to do.
Yeah.
So one is the search or discovery of some sort of purpose or meaning
that gives me some direction. That could be one way, and I will give you some very interesting examples of that. Okay, what else?
Just slowing down or stopping thinking about the state of the situation. Maybe by making a list, which will slow down your thinking, or just stop thinking about it completely.
So, detaching yourself from the situation that is creating the confusion in various ways, detachment. Moving away, moving outside. Alright? So the understanding of some meaning or purpose, the moving away from that situation sometimes, yes?
Trying to figure out what feels best.
What feels best?
Stomach.
What feels best? Do you mean to say what is really important for me?
What feels best in the body?
What feels best? Oh, are you thinking about a difficulty in choosing which kind of food to eat, for example?
Okay.
Yes. So what is important? What feels good? Were you saying something?
To be so peaceful so you can hear the unconscious be conscious.
Wow. To be so peaceful that you can actually hear the unconscious. Again, in a sense, detachment. Moving away from that situation into a state of silence where you can actually hear. What are the other aspects? Yes?
I was thinking like the trust in intuition.
Trust. What do you mean by that trust?
I also feel like kind of peace and then I believe in my inner side.
Okay, so there, you're speaking about faith, what makes you happy, what makes you feel good, a sense of peace. In other words, we are basically speaking about what is really, really important for me. And we can speak about it in different ways. Today we will speak about it as we have usually been speaking about it, in terms of what is of value to me, what is valuable to me, what are the values that are really, really important to me. We can have many other things, but due to the paucity of time, let's work with this. Because there is also, one is we understand that our clear understanding of what is important, what has value, gives me clarity. An understanding of purpose and meaning gives me clarity. The ability to move away from a situation also gives me clarity. And we can work with many other things, but today we will work with these three things. Could there be a problem with values, purpose, and detachment? Could there be a problem? Could there be a flip side to clarity?
If you don't have an emotional issue, then clarity and objectifying is not really a solution.
Because there, it is not, it is like, you know, we are engaging in an ego defense mechanism where we are rationalizing or intellectualizing. This is very interesting. Clarity can also, this understanding of what is right, can also be a result of ego defense mechanisms of, say, for example, rationalizing, explaining your choice to yourself so that you can feel good about yourself. Or intellectualizing, distancing yourself from an emotional experience which is painful, and then justifying what you have done, the actions you have done, through intellectualizing. And the last week I was in Germany. I had gone with a group of students on field study. And the aim was to look at culture. Understand culture. Why does culture emerge? What are the roots of culture? How do people make meaning? See purpose, right? And as a part of that, we were also looking at, is it possible for cultures to be constructed that are evil? What is evil? And people would say evil is a construction. Evil is a social construction. Yeah. Will we all say that whatever happened, for example, during the Second World War, it's just an interpretation? Would anyone say that? There are some people who would say that. Would any of you say that? Well, it's just an interpretation. You can see it as good. It would be difficult to digest that explanation, right?
And we were looking at also some of these aspects around clarity. The Nazis had great clarity. They had, I mean, amazing clarity. I mean, that is true. They had a clear sense of direction. No confusion. Clear sense of direction. They were operating with a purpose. There were certain values that they held very, very important. All these things were there, and that gave that whole movement a great power, a great focus. And they achieved what they set out to achieve to a large extent. But we know, of course, that it's very, very destructive, pathological. So clarity can also emerge in extremely pathological ways. Out of confusion, created, for example, in the history of the First World War, the period after the First World War, there is upheaval in society, there is confusion in society. And in moments of uncertainty and confusion, you want to hold on to something. Someone comes up with an ideology, frames that ideology in a certain way that makes a lot of sense. It's rational. It is objective. Mixed a little bit with Darwin's theory of evolution. Mixed it a little bit with Nietzsche's theory of, you know, power. Mix it a little bit, take a little bit from here, take a little bit from there, a little bit from there, and frame it in a way, in an argument that makes sense. People, it made sense to people. It gave them meaning. There were certain values, and then you see what happens. That is, of course, an extreme form of clarity, which can be very, very destructive. But at a lower level, you look at the micro level, our own behavior, sometimes we have a clear sense of purpose in our life. And we pursue that purpose with great motivation, great determination. Does that mean necessarily that that is really right for us? Let me give another example. Moving away now, and the Nazi episode itself is not something very new in history, right? You have Islamic terrorism, same thing. Same thing. You take some aspects of the philosophy of a religion, you take some aspects from the life of the religious founders, you take some aspects from recent history of some discrimination and exploitation, you frame it all together in a certain way, it makes a lot of sense. These people are evil, they need to be destroyed, they have discriminated against us, and you justify it. Oh, the Prophet also fought war against evil, and you frame it in a certain way. Makes a lot of sense. You have great clarity, great purpose, strong values. You create very strong organizations that are completely destructive for the self and for others. We've seen that during the Christian Crusades earlier on in the medieval ages. Same story. You frame certain things in a certain way, there is a sense of purpose, there are strong values, and we create a lot of destruction. So there are various aspects of clarity. Look at organizations now. We have the value of adult choice, right? And there are some studies on this. For example, companies that manufacture tobacco and sell tobacco. Now, this is an going on debate, right? Adult choice. People should be free to smoke if they want to smoke. And great organizations like, for example, Philip Morris, making lots of tobacco, they say, oh, this is our, we will stand by this value and we will sell this because people should have a choice and they should decide to do whatever. And that's fine. That's fine. Because it's not very fashionable to say that you can't have that after all. It is another choice. But if there's a debate, is that okay? Coming to individual level, I'll give you an example. So there was this, I remember, a student of mine, a very interesting thing happened in one of my classes one day. So this guy enters the business school with great purpose, very clear sense of direction, strong values. One of his values is, you know, this intellectualism, rationality, the ability to see things clearly, objectively, analyze them, come to clear conclusions based on objective analysis of facts. At the same time, a clear sense of purpose. He wants to stand out. He wants to achieve. He wants to accomplish something. That's a sense of purpose. So in the beginning, in the orientation, we have these workshops around values and purpose. And students come up with all these things. My purpose is, you know, meaning. Life should have a meaning. Where will meaning come from? From achievement. That's fine, right? sense of achievement. How will I achieve? Well, I have to use all the resources I have, my intellectual abilities, all the talents I have in the best possible way. Fair enough, right? So this guy walks into the MBA program with this clear sense of his values and a sense of clear purpose and direction, and he basically wants to experience meaning and all that stuff. And he enters the class, and he was in one of my courses that was organizational behavior. We look at behavior in organizations, decision making, etc., etc. Very interesting thing happened. So we were doing a case study on a hospital. This is a hospital from America. The hospital had decided on a very interesting policy which was very different. The hospital decided, we want to have total disclosure of all the mistakes that we do, and it's a children's hospital. They decided, whenever we make a mistake, say for example, overdose of some medicine that is dangerous, anything that is life-threatening, we have to call the parents and tell them that we made this mistake. Why on earth would a business organization do that, right? So it's a very controversial thing. And it's something very new. I mean, it's a business organization, it wants to make money, and then it wants to go and do something like that. So obviously there are concerns. You start going around revealing your mistakes to your clients, to your customers, you will end up with a lot of lawsuits. And it's America, right? You can sue anyone for anything. So that's ridiculous. So this is debate going on in this hospital. On the other hand, there is this debate, no, we need to have full disclosure, because when we have full disclosure, everyone will become more responsible. Because they know the stakes are high, they will make sure they don't make mistakes, and you know, we will give them support and all that. This whole debate was going on. So in the class, we had this debate, right? So many, interestingly, most people in the class said, yes, it makes sense because the hospital is going to develop goodwill, people will trust the hospital and all that, so it's good for the business. And some people, very few people said, this is rubbish, it doesn't make sense, it's a business organization, you shouldn't be bothered with some, you know, it's all idealism and somebody wants to do something nice, but it doesn't make any sense, it doesn't matter. This boy was one of the leader of this group of people who were arguing that this is ridiculous, it doesn't make any sense. So he took that stand. Now, once he's taken that stand, you know, generally what happens when we take a stand, then we feel compelled to defend that stand. So he's taken that stand. Now, they didn't know what was happening. The next session, I wanted to give them a case of the functioning of the hospital 6 years after they took their decision to see really what happened. I gave them the case. And then they studied the case, and they were supposed to come back and then analyze on whether the hospital is actually benefiting from that policy or not. So this guy, he's very interested, he takes the case and he scans through the case and he sees that everything seems to be happening okay. There is no increase in lawsuits, inpatients are increasing, the hospital is doing fine. He couldn't figure out, this is uncertainty, right? He's not able to see any clear proof that the policy that he was standing against was working out wrong. And then in the exhibits at the end of the case, there was a financial statement. That's a phone. But there was a financial statement. And in that financial statement, you have the revenue of the hospital and the net profit for all the years, about 6 years in a row. Right? The last year, the revenue was half of the previous year. The last year, the revenue shown was half of the previous year. He zoomed into that figure. We're looking for data to support our stand, right? So he zoomed into that figure and he said, ah, this is interesting. And then he made sure that it was actually that figure, he made some calculations, he said, I got this. And then he went and spoke to some people, he saw that no one had figured that out, so he felt, great, this is my trump card. And he didn't say all this to me then, but I found out later. So he comes to class fully prepared with that analysis that, see, I was right, and the hospital has failed. And did that. What he forgot to see was on the top of the column, in bold letters, there were three letters, YTD, year to date. It was not the whole year. It was only for the first or second quarter of that year. Right? That information completely was screened out. He lashed onto that. He came to class And then he was very clever. He waited for everybody to make their case because he knew he had a great thing to show to everyone. So everybody made their arguments. Everybody said, yeah, it seems to be working out well. Even those people who were against that stand, they said eventually, oh, no, actually, you were wrong, but it seems to be working out well. And after all this discussion, he raises his hand and he says, I beg to differ. I said, okay, this is very interesting. So I said, okay, would you like to come up and tell us why you beg to differ? So he comes up to the stage, he gets onto the stage and the podium, and he says, the hospital has made a terrible failure. He pronounces, and he says, I ask you all to turn to the exhibit, and you can see your figures, and he gave a big explanation, and he explained those figures through some other data in the case, you know, why that happened, and the other data in the case supports that the figures have gone down. Everybody's face in the class was of shock. And he couldn't figure out why is everybody shocked. They should be saying, ooh, ah, yeah, that's great. No one's saying that. Everybody is like shocked. They don't know what's happening. And then, of course, people said, but have you looked at the figures? And he looks at the figure and he says, oh, and you know what? I saw something very sad. I saw his face completely crumbled. And it's a small thing, right? It's a very small thing. But when our sense of self is so much invested in proving and achieving and deriving a sense of meaning through this achievement, and that is anchored on something like that, completely crumbled, he went and he sat and I saw he was really, really low. He didn't go for lunch that day. It affected him so, it was an extreme case, it affected him so much that he completely backed out of almost all interaction in the class after that day. And he was a very talented guy. He was a musician, he had his own music group, he was great in advertising and marketing, he had a good understanding of psychology. Completely he withdrew, sitting in a corner, just sitting in his room playing the guitar, not interacting with anyone. It took him, then I called him and I spoke to him, and then all these things came out. Yeah, all the expectations from home, his family is full of high achievers. His father is someone, and the grandfather was someone, and the grandmother was someone, and everybody is someone. So he comes to school with wanting to be someone, right? And he has a clear sense of purpose, a clear understanding of who he is in terms of his values, coming from his family. This is the constructed self that we speak about as the ego. So my understanding of purpose, my understanding of values can be influenced from what we call the ego or the constructed self. The same thing with my purpose, it can come from the sense of ego or my constructed self, or it can come from something deeper that we refer to as the soul. And both can give us clarity. Both can give a clear sense of direction in our life. But in one, when it is driven by the ego, when we are able to succeed, we feel great. And when we fail, we feel very, 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 very low, very miserable. So, we need to detach, but we also need to very clearly discern where is the sense of purpose and values coming from. Is it coming from the space of the ego, the constructed self? All these things I have taken in from the world in the process of growing up, all these standards that I believe are important to achieve meaning and self-worth and all those things, is it coming from that, or is it coming from something far deeper? How will we know that? Yes, yes.
I mean, there are some, you know, like the school system and even in the society, workplace, and they have built up a deep egoic values because you have to reach certain marks to go to study. For example, psychology, it's very high.
It's very tough.
Yeah, so it also that. You have a society that creates so much from.
So what is then my role? Do I say, okay, I'm going to be the victim of society? Or do I choose consciously to insulate myself?
But is it possible to choose with the soul when you have such marks you have to achieve, for example?
Good question. Is it possible?
That's what I mean.
I would say yes, of course it is possible. Otherwise, why would we be here? Of course it is possible. It is a question of consciously choosing what I want to be and who I want to be. I tell you something very interesting. my own personal story, right? Very, very interesting. Two experiences. One is from the time when I was very, very young. I was in school. So I was, what, 16, 17, that time, right? So the world, the peer pressure, the pressure of society, proving to the world who you are, plus all those teenage hormones, you know, it's a pretty interesting time to be in. So everything is sort of mixed up. It's very chaotic. You have all these hormones coming up, and then you see all these movies, and then you have all the pressure from society, and the peer group is telling you, oh, to be a person of worth, you have to be like this, you have to be cool, you have to be... And, you know, growing up in a culture that is very, very competitive. Denmark is not that competitive. Yeah, it's quite relaxed. It's nice. That's one very nice thing about Denmark, right? So, of course, there are some people comparing now Danish schools with Chinese schools, and one of my friends is an anthropologist. He comes up with these two pictures, right, of the Chinese classroom and the Danish classroom. The Chinese classroom, everybody is like this. Danish classroom, so the other side of it, right? And then they say, okay, how is it affecting people and all that? But anyway, so I was growing up in this kind of a competitive society, right, where you have to be this and all out and stuff like that. Anyway, apart from that competitiveness, there was also this experience of... I got into an interesting group of people, basically a gang, right? Now the secrets are coming out. Skeletons in the cupboard. Gang, but I mean, honestly, I didn't really do much. But, and this is the truth, I'm not hiding anything. But I sort of hang around with them. And some of these people are pretty dangerous, I mean, actually dangerous people. They walk around with daggers and knives and guns, and they used to use them. Some of them were paid for using them. I mean, there was a lot of seriously dangerous stuff going around. And the kind of environment I was in, the kind of friends I used to hang around with, the norms were, this is cool. All these contra-cultures, this is cool. You're macho when you're a man, and, you know, that means you go out and beat up a few people and you do all these things. This was cool. And I remember, I somehow from my childhood, I was not a very violent person. I couldn't get myself to hit anyone. Even when I was in school, you know, I'd get into a fight with someone and they would try and punch. I could never punch. I would hold their hands and wrestle with them. But I couldn't land a punch on their face. I couldn't do it. So when I was in this kind of a group, obviously I felt a bit, you know, a bit of difficulty in accepting. At the same time, the pressure, you're in part of this group and you want to be cool and you want to be accepted by your peers and all this. And these are the people that are getting a lot of attention from everyone and everybody thinks they are really cool. I remember there were times when these guys used to plan, let's catch up that guy and beat him up. And I would say, oh, really, do you have to beat him up? You know, you can speak to him. And they would say, what's wrong with you, man? And I would say, yeah, something's wrong with me. And there were moments when I came so close to going with them to beat up someone. So close. That temptation was so close, so much. Fortunately, at the last moment, I would stop myself. I would say, this is crazy. I'm getting out. And then they would say, what's wrong with you? I said, no, I you're not a man. Okay, whatever, you know, I'm out. And fortunately, sometime I got out. Now, one example from my life, yes, there are pressures from society, but we also have choice. It doesn't matter how strong the pressure. You know, we were in Sachsenhausen, this Nazi concentration camp memorial, north of Berlin. And I was asking the students, you know, these people who perpetrated these atrocities, they were people like us. They were not very different. They were people like us, like you and me. What made them do things like that? Could we end up in situations where norms are so strong that you sort of end up playing that role because you find there to be no choice? So this is the other aspect, right? Extreme examples. But then, don't we have choice? There is always a choice. There was always a choice. We met some people working with the people who were working in East Germany, East Berlin. These people who were to stand by the wall, Berlin Wall, and shoot people who were crossing over. So one argument is, they were not responsible, they were just carrying out the orders. So should they be put on trial? When the wall fell down and Germany emerged, this was the question. Should they be put on trial? How are they responsible for what they did? They were following orders. And yet they were put on trial. Yes, they were following orders, but there was also an element of choice. So you have these questions. Do we just give in blindly to the forces operating upon us, or do we deliberately take a choice where we decide that we want to go our own way, informed on something much deeper? So the ego, the constructed self, is giving me a set of values, making me believe that something is a sense of purpose. Can I discern? Can I differentiate? How can I discern between whether my sense of purpose and values and direction is coming from the space of the soul or the space of the ego? How can we differentiate? How can we discern? What could be a yardstick for that?
Happiness or...
But you know, I can be very happy when I achieve an egocentric goal. I feel great. I mean, you know, I become the president of the world, whatever. I feel great. There is this happiness in that as well. Right? I meet someone, fall in love with me. There is a happiness in that as well. How do I discern? How do I discern what is the happiness that is ego-driven and the happiness that is deeper? How do I discern? What would be a yardstick for that?
That you are not attached, that you aren't attached to whatever gives you pleasure.
That could be a very nice yardstick. In the experience of a happiness that is deeper, there is inherent in that experience of happiness is a sense of detachment. There is no getting carried away. There is no sitting and thinking about that experience again and again and again and again, squeezing out the happiness from that experience. That doesn't happen. There is automatically a sense of detachment involved in that experience of happiness. And this is how we can discern, we can differentiate. This happiness, this sense of detachment that comes from and gives us clarity is informed by a deep experience of satisfaction. Now, this is not superficial satisfaction. We say deep satisfaction, which is basically a state of bliss we experience from deep inside, coming from the experience of the original self or the soul. And there is automatically an experience of detachment in that. That, can you relate to that? Yes? It is hard. It is really hard. It is not easy at all. And this is the task of spiritual practice. In meditation, really, if we are practicing meditation and spirituality properly, our task would be really to discern. And this takes some time, but it is possible. Initially, we don't have a conscious experience of a state of happiness where you are also detached. We don't have that much. So initially when we say that, it doesn't make sense. We can't relate to it very clearly. But when we start practicing that state of happiness that comes from a state of detachment, in time, we are able to figure out the difference between the two. So one way is very clearly, if my mind is being pulled by the experience again and again and again, and I'm squeezing out the happiness from that experience, I feel great, there is some element perhaps of the ego being involved. A, one yardstick. Another yardstick is, in a spiritual experience of happiness and deep satisfaction, there is no discrimination. There is no discrimination between different people. There is no sense of condemning one and favoring another. Even though the person might have done something very nice and helped many people, say for example, let's take unfortunate example, but okay, Hitler, right? Let's take someone else, say Martin Luther King Jr., right? Now, we know that some of the things that this guy did were not very good for humanity. Things that this guy did were very good for humanity. You see that very clearly. There is clarity. At the same time, there is also judgment. There is also judgment because you judge this is right and this is wrong. But there is no condemnation. There is no hatred. There is no dislike towards one over the other. This is a state of detachment that comes from a sense of fullness. So you're able to see the difference. You're even able to judge. You're even able to take action. So for example, you're working in an office and you're responsible for 10 people. Two of these people have been caught engaging in unethical practices. You see that. You take a judgment on that. You can even pass an action, punishment, expel them from the organization, whatever it is, but there is no feeling of a negative emotion towards them. This is the state of spiritual equanimity. Does it make sense? Theoretically, does it make sense? Experientially, does it make sense? Have you experienced that state ever?
Maybe I should say, but I think I'm there, actually.
Chiluka?
Yeah.
Because my goal in life is to sleep happy and wake up happy. And I completely want to be selected in terms of what I want to feed myself in my brain. And people come to me and say, why are you so happy? It's just why I'm surprised because I really don't know. I don't want to involve myself in it.
Thank you for saying that because actually it's not a big thing. It's not a big thing. It's very human. All souls experience that state. All of us have experienced that state. And all of us are capable of experiencing that state. It's a question of understanding when it happens. Haven't you ever had experiences where suddenly, even though you might not have been practicing meditation or anything, but suddenly you experience yourself moving into a state where you feel, if I could say that without sounding blasphemous, godlike? But not in an egotistical way, but in a way where you love everyone. Have you ever found yourself in that state? Connected with everyone, connected with the universe, we just love everyone. And yet it's not a state where you want to go and hug people and, you know, it's not that. The sense of detachment, but there's also the sense of love. How many of you have ever experienced this state at some point? It could be in meditation, it could be outside meditation. Many of us do. We are capable of experiencing that state. It's a natural state because that is the natural state of the soul. Many a times we experience that state but we don't remember it. It just comes and goes because it is so natural. The aim behind meditation is to create more and more experiences of this state of detachment that comes from a deep sense of satisfaction, that comes from engaging in thoughts of the original self. Meditation is nothing but creating thoughts and experiences of the original self. And connected to this, the understanding of the deep inner values, which we speak about in Hindi and Sanskrit as dharma. That is the religion of the self. The deep original religion of the self, which means basically the religion of love and happiness and peace and all those things which are essential. Along with that, we also have this experience of deep meaning or deep purpose, which is often referred to as following our sense of karma or action. Meaning. There is a very deep understanding of purpose. This purpose is not the kind of purpose or kind of meaning we experience by achieving something out there. But this is a deep sense of purpose that we experience when we are able to bring benefit to others. It's very, very simple. It's bringing benefit to others. It doesn't matter where we are. And this is where we say karma, because karma also means destiny. But karma also means action. The understanding that wherever I am in my life, that is where I am meant to be. That is my existential ground. And because it is my existential ground, it is my existential responsibility to bring benefit to the people in that ground of existence. If I move outside that ground, if I escape from the challenges in that ground, I am going against my karma, I am going against my purpose. And many a times, this is something I need to understand. If I, for example, I'm having difficulties with my mother, for example, unable to solve it, I get out of that situation, I'll feel happy. The problem is gone. I can go to the Brahma Kumari Meditation Center and meditate. Bombs out. Problem's gone. I feel happy. But that is an ego-informed happiness because I have escaped from my existential responsibility of addressing a situation that needed addressing. And what happens then usually, because that situation has not come from her, it has come from me, and it has come from my unique relationship with her. And because the problem has not been solved, this pattern between us, which also involves me, has not been solved. And so what happens then is that pattern will repeat in other relationships. And so temporarily, we find an escape, and then we repeat the same pattern again. Find another escape, repeat it again, another escape, and then we go on, and we end up with so many. And the more we repeat, the deeper that pattern becomes. And therefore, spirituality is not just sitting, we keep saying that, it's not sitting in meditation, but it is also understanding our existential responsibility and using thoughts of the original self to address the challenges in a situation. So when I say experience of the original self, it does not just mean experience of the original self here. It also means experience of the original self there and there and there and there. Understanding that this person is creating difficulties for me, at least I believe the person is creating difficulties for me, but the person originally is not that. The person has become that. It's the constructed self, the ego, within that person who is behaving in this way. The original self is different. The person is unable to work from the space of the original self. And that is why the person is behaving like that. But there is this original experience of the self which I can see in this person. So thoughts of the original self does not just mean thoughts of myself, but also thoughts of the original self when it comes to others. And then it becomes easier for us to stay in that situation. Look at the beauty in the other. Transform that pattern that is creating that behavior, because that behavior is towards me, so the pattern is rooted in both of us, not just in her, not just in him, and not just in me. It's rooted in both. There is a pattern, there is an exchange, there is a relationship in which there is an I and a you. And the I doesn't exist without the you. You doesn't exist without the I. Imagine if all people in the world were Danes. All people in the world were Danes. Stereotypical Danes. Blonde hair, blue eyes, which very few Danes have. But anyway, blonde hair, blue eyes. Whole world, everybody speaks Danish. Everybody lives in Denmark. There is no country in the world except... Would you even call your country Denmark?
No.
Would you call yourself Danish?
No.
The I exists because there are others who are not like I. The I is born out of you. Because there are others who are not Danes, I call myself a Dane or an Indian, whatever it is. If everybody was the same, I wouldn't call myself anything. I have the need to call myself I because there are others who are not I. And there is you and there is they. And I differentiate myself. But I is born out of you and they. That is relationship. So if there is a problem in a relationship, it's not rooted just in that person. The pattern is connected between the I and the you. And if I don't address that, it will repeat. The challenge of spirituality is staying in the situation where my ground of existence is and addressing that situation right there. There is such great strength. That is the deeper experience of purpose. There is a release of something. Something inside changes. We become free. For example, recently I met a girl. She's working in this group in a company. She's very, very, very talented and amazing and all that stuff. So that she has another person joining her team who is also talented and amazing and all that stuff. In fact, she's very much like her. So both these girls working in this group. And she has begun to feel that this person is interfering with my work. This person is crossing boundaries. Boundaries of my work and her work, and she's crossing the boundaries. And she was contemplating going and speaking to that person and giving her a piece of her mind, you know, being direct and honest and all that stuff, and telling her what she thinks. And what she thinks basically is, you're crossing boundaries here, you're coming into my area of work, and all that stuff. But she wanted to be clear, confusion. She didn't know whether she should do that or not. And so she spoke to me about that. And we spoke about it. And we found something very interesting. Her belief that the other is crossing the lines was just a belief. In reality, she was not crossing any lines. You know where it was coming from? Ego. But what aspect of the ego? Jealousy. Jealousy, because the other girl in the team was getting a lot of recognition for all the things that she earlier had got recognition for. So this person is getting recognition for a lot of things. This person comes in with similar competencies. And so she starts getting recognition for all those things. She starts feeling jealous. She feels as though her existence, her ego existence is being compromised. You know, her sense of worth is being compromised. And then that experience starts making her look at her behavior in a negative way, when in reality it is not negative. And if she had gone and spoken to her like that, she would have certainly destroyed that relationship. She would have destroyed the dynamics in the team. She would have destroyed the effectiveness of that team. Awareness. Knowledge of the self also requires knowledge of the ego. I also need to understand whether I'm operating from that space of the ego. And there is this anger. She wanted to... The sign of... If there is anger, there is a sign that something is coming from the space of the ego. And I want to tell that person, you know, I want to give them a piece of my mind. And I want to set them right. This is something not quite right. Because it is coming from the space of the ego. She recognized that. She did not speak to her about that. Instead, she went and she told her about all the wonderful things she brings to the team. All the resources she brings to the team. And that she's really glad that she now has a strong resource in the team. The relationship became closer. The experience of that person crossing boundaries went away automatically. Because she chose to work from the space of the original self. Simple example. You wanted to say something?
Actually, I wanted to ask what she did in the
end. Yeah, I said that. This is crossing, this is going over, transcending, going deep, detaching yourself from the situation, looking at it from a distance. No, that is not right. This is coming from the space of the ego. I need to move into something larger, the space of the soul, that what we call the space of the soul. It is very, very practical. Because that space helps us connect, unite with others, and work with people. And even then, even if the person is actually crossing boundaries, that person will stop doing that. Because that person feels secure. You communicate to that person in that way, the person starts feeling secure. You can actually work well as a team. Great practical utility in working from the space of the soul. But that requires strength. That requires practice. Sometimes it requires a lot of communication, like in this case. But the practice of meditation naturally takes us into that space again and again and again and again. So in reality, when we face circumstances, because we have the practice of going beyond the ego into the space of the soul, because we have the practice, we can do it quickly and move on. Yes?
Have you tried changing your relationship with your mother?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, I have. And I have succeeded. Thank you very much for bringing that up. I love my mom. She loves me. And honestly, there was a time when I really hated her. There was a time when I really hated her. Why? I really hated her. She's not around. Oh, I'm on record. No, I need to. That's terrible. I need to erase that. But there was a time, really. And you know, I was asking myself, why is that? Simple reasons. She didn't please my ego. Very simple. At the end of the day, basically, she didn't please my ego. My dad, I love, because he always pleased my ego. He was always kind and nice and buying me things and whatever I wanted anytime, it was always there. So, great dad, because he pleased my ego. My mom, I ask her something, why do you need it? Come on, I need it. No, you will get it after a month. And that doesn't please my ego. She's bad. And all these childish things I carried with me, right? And honestly, when I started practicing spirituality is when I recognized that's just silly. If she was actually preventing me from getting some things because she thought that would not be good for me, she was working from a space of love. It just didn't fit in with my ego and my desire, right? Once I began to understand that, no problem now. There was a time when I would not speak to her, you know, I'll move away and not speak, and then she would get angry and not speak and all that stuff. But that's like moving away. That doesn't help. You were saying something?
No, I was just... If she did do something that was bad for you...
You know, it's a perception. It's really a perception. And even if there was something that was bad, right? I mean, I've done bad things in my life. You know? I want people to forgive me. And she didn't really do anything bad as such. But even if she had really, I mean, come on. We all do something which we have not. I would rather look at the intentions. And her intentions were good, right? She didn't mean to cause any anger in me. She just thought what she would, you know, she did what she thought was best. So yes, it is possible to transform, not just with my mother, but also with many friends, with colleagues. You work with that and you transform, working from the space of the self. But we have to now wind up. We'll do a little meditation before we wind up for today. Okay, thank you. So, you could practice. We have our next talk, I think, again after a month or so. 2-3 weeks, I think. You could practice this experience of the original self. And that, of course, means knowledge of the original self. And in the philosophy of Raja Yoga, when we say the original self, we mean the soul. When we say the soul, we mean basically a culmination of two things. One is, it's the being of light, energy. It's a being that is full of all the qualities of love and peace and happiness and purity. That is the original quality of the soul. And so, engaging in thoughts of the original self would mean first engaging in thoughts about the self in that way that I am that being of love and peace and happiness and purity, and which also means practicing these values in our life, in our relationships, but also looking at others with the same vision. Does it make sense? Is it practical? So you could practice this. And then we move into a state of clarity that is beyond the ego, where you can see things clearly from a distance. And sometimes alternatives that were very confusing become irrelevant because you have gone beyond the ego. The alternatives actually become irrelevant. And because you're seeing things from a distance, we can actually then choose what is it that I need to do. I think to wind up, one experience is very relevant here. It's my experience. I've shared this, I think, before, but I will say this again because it's relevant here. When I was coming to Denmark, so I didn't know anyone here. I didn't have a job. I didn't have an apartment. And I knew no one. All I knew, there was a meditation center here, and that's it. And I had no place to stay. And then I got in touch with some people, and one person said that, yes, you can share my apartment for some time till you find your own apartment. Well, that was very nice. I said, okay, now I have a place to stay. And I planned everything. I resigned from my job. I, you know, bought foreign currency and everything. Everything was done. Tickets were bought 2 weeks before my departure. And 2 weeks before my departure, I get information from this person saying, well, I'm sorry, you can't stay with me. He gave his reasons for that. Good reasons, but that's it. And I remember I entered into a state of confusion. More than confusion, it was anxiety. And confusion. Should I go? Should I not go? What should I do now? I don't even have a place to stay. Copenhagen is not the cheapest place in the world. And even if it's, you know, expensive, I should have a place and I can't find an apartment. And what should I do? So this is a state of confusion, state of anxiety. And I said, well, I'm supposed to be practicing meditation for so many years, so I should be able to find an answer to this by myself. I did something very simple. And I had, by the way, 70 people coming down in the afternoon to learn meditation. I was in no state to teach any meditation to anyone. I was in no state to practice meditation. My first temptation was, I should cancel that talk and try and find an apartment in Copenhagen. I said, right, in the next 2 hours, I'm going to find an apartment in Copenhagen. Fantastic. That's ridiculous. So now I'm going to have the meditation, I'm going to go there, and I'm going to teach meditation. And I went there in front, 70 people like you sitting in front, and inside there's a storm going on, and I'm sitting there, Om Shanti. In the beginning, it was very superficial. But you also move into that space. Then I sat down and meditated. And I did that practice, going beyond who is feeling anxious. It is the ego. The ego is afraid. It is this physical existence that needs a place, security, this and that. The soul is free. And I went to this experience of soul consciousness, going beyond the body, going beyond all the limitations of the body, going beyond all the desires of this physical world. That's the practice of yoga, connecting with God, staying in that light, in deep concentration for 10 minutes. I had the most wonderful experience. That anxiety, that confusion, it sort of disappeared. It was a physical experience. I could feel it evaporating. It just disappeared. I was left with great clarity, a great sense of purpose. And I asked myself, am I still going there? I don't have to. My boss will be very happy to have me back. I know that. He told me that. Do I go or do I not go? The answer was very clear. Yes, I'm going. That's where my purpose is at the moment. That's my karma. I'm going. I don't have a place, no problem, I'll find it. Clear, in the midst of uncertainty, complete clarity, coming from this process of transcending the ego. So that's an experience. Let's practice that. When we go into the experience of the self, and when we are in touch with the eternal self, we can see very clearly our own purpose in front of us. The path becomes clear. There is a light shining from the present that reveals the path in front of us. And experiences.
experience this physical world and this physical body disappear from my awareness, fading into the distance, melting away into the elements of matter. All that remains is light. And I see myself beyond the limits of this physical world, beyond the earth, beyond the moon, beyond the sun and the stars. I go into the dimension of light, the dimension of silence. And I find myself in the presence of God, the Supreme Light. I rest in the embrace of that light. And I listen to the deep, blissful silence. Just two beings of light. In deep, silent communion, I, the soul, and my Supreme Father, Mother, Friend, Companion, holding on to the silence and this light, I allow myself to return back to this world, back to this body, to once again take my place in the center of the brain, looking out through the windows of these eyes, listening through these ears, spreading the light of life throughout the brain and the body. I, the eternal spirit within, the being of light, the being of peace,
go off.